whoever did this originally must have fussed around with it until he got it to where it worked nicely. So that's the thing. I guess one other thing I was going to mention. I think we should at least mention what the dish oil tuning method is. And I will go ahead and do that if you, unless you want to, Dick.
Yeah, I recommend you don't do that right now. But you did bring up a very good 2 points there, and then I'm going to review this with John. And that is, microstrip is where you've got a ground plane, your dielectric material, FR4 board or whatever, or G10 board, and then a circuit sitting on top. Microstrip basically does a little bit of resonating, and to build a filter in microstrip, Doug, I strongly recommend you don't do it, because the input circuit can radiate directly to the output circuit, ignore the filter, and it's not very well shielded. Strip line is where you have a lower ground plane, dielectric material, the circuit in the middle, dielectric material, upper ground plane, a completely shielded structure. And so he's recommending that if you build it in printed circuit board, go strip line, not microstrip, on any filter. I strongly agree with him on that. Let me drop, he's going to make another point. Up till now, you and I have been talking about interdigital filters, John, where one end of the is directly grounded to wall, and the other end is floating with maybe a tuning screw at the end of it. If you instead use a make these filters, it make the individual elements U-shaped. The U-shaped are going to give you twice as much length, but you get a lot higher Q. If you build the tuning elements as a left-handed U, a right-handed U, and a left-handed U, and they're all side-by-side, these U-shaped tuning elements, you end up with a lot more filter good characteristic. You get a lot more running Q, so to speak, with that method of construction. It turns out that any method of grounding the rod to the wall or grounding the line to the wall, so to speak, you end up with a little bit of, what's the word I'm looking for here, contact resistance, which lowers the performance of the filter very slightly. If you want to go the next step, make the filters out of U-shaped resonators. And the fact that there's 380 megacycle no-tune filter, that's that guy, I can't think of the guy's call letters, but you just simply start Googling no-tune transverter, and there's a whole series of articles on local oscillators and transverters and mixers and so on of the no-tune variety. He had a whole series of articles in QSD Magazine on that one, too. And he uses these U-shaped resonators. So give them some thought also, because you get more performance with less work, if you know what I mean. And that thing that was in Doug's hand, that's the way it was constructed. So I'm going to go on now, John, and good luck with that project, and come back next week and tell us how it's going. I think the next person on our list was John. But John did say after we go to Mel's...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
We are supposed to be on the mailbag at this time. So, here we go. Mel, K2KEY, tell us what kind of mail you've gotten this week, Doug. K2K, here we go. Boy, am I mixed up tonight, Mel. K2KEY, his name is Mel. He's the co-host. Go ahead, Mel, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay. This is K2KEY, this is Prince Man. Just getting off the phone with my daughter. Okay, we're on time today for some unusual reason. This before. All right, let's see if I can find something of interest here. Written by newcomer to ham radio. That's my specialty here. What does this guy have to say? No, can't answer that question. This we've gone through too many times. Okay, here's one. I inherited a HQ-180 Omnilon receiver. Oh, yes. And it's working off and on. I'll tell you about other problems. But basically, I don't understand what the heck they mean here. That it, they give you an outline of the receiver's operation, and it says it is a triple conversion receiver. Just quickly give me an idea. What the heck are they talking about? Over.
This is a good illuminating question on the subject of receivers. It turns out that in the very early days, the very first radios that ever existed, were either TRF, tuned radio frequency, was some of the very first ones. In fact, in a great big wooden cabinet in the attic of my grandfather's farm was one of these receivers he bought, I guess, in the 1920 time frame. And what literally it existed of is a great big air variable capacitor that looked like it was part of a transmitter, but that tuned the first input resonator that came from the antenna. And there was a total of four of these things. We had four cascaded filters with tube amplifiers in between them. And if you wanted to listen to the AM broadcast band on one megacycle, every one of those stages was tuned by you by setting the dials all to the same number. They were all tuned to one megacycle. And at the tail end of all of that amplification, there was a detector, an audio amplifier, and it went to the loudspeaker. That was the very first kind of radios. Great big bulky things. Very difficult to build enough bandwidth, selectivity of those filters and so on. Tuned radio frequency working directly at the RF was the very early days of radio. Along came a man named Armstrong, and he invented, among other things, he invented something called superheterodyne. Let me drop. Superheterodyne is just a fancy name where he takes the RF frequency, tunes it, amplifies it a little bit, and plugs it into a mixer. The mixer takes you one megacycle signal and in many cases beats it down to a lower frequency where the first IF might be 455 KC, half of one megacycle, or maybe even lower. But by beating it down to a lower frequency, you get a whole lot of advantages. At the lower frequency, gain is cheaper, easier to get. Sharper filtering at the lower frequency is easier to get. And that's the good news. The bad news is that you have a little bit of problem if your first IF is half a megacycle and you're mixing with it with a local oscillator on the high side, you're going to really have two responses, a sum product and a difference product. The local oscillator might be at 1.5 megs. You beat it against the one megacycle signal, out comes the IF of 0.5 megs. Well, there's also another response at 0.5 plus 1.5, 2 megs. So the radio is really listening to two megacycles and one megacycle simultaneously with that single conversion that I just described. And as long as your RF amplifier is selective enough to favor the one meg signal, the desired signal, and not favor the 2 meg signal, the image signal, in my particular example, then everything's hunky-dory. So when it comes to much higher frequency receivers, like the 2 meter band, 144 megacycles, let me drop. A real good receiver on 144 megacycles will take 144 megacycles and beat it down to a first IF of maybe 10.7 megacycles. And you put some gain there. And there your image is going to be 21 megacycles away, and it's pretty easy to reject it. But then you're still not getting enough filtering at 10 megacycles, and you go to another mixing stage, and you mix it down to 455 KC. So first IF is 10.7 meg, 7 IF is 455 KC, and then the final filtering and amplification, detecting, and audio amplifier takes place there. I've just described a double conversion receiver. And by the same process, if you were building a receiver at 1,000 megacycles, you might use as the first IF 100 meg, as the second IF 10 megs, as the third IF half a meg. A good rule of thumb for a proper design of a superheterodyne receiver is that each IF frequency should be approximately one-tenth of the frequency that preceded it. So you recognize in that example, let me drop. A good receiver for 1,000 megs would convert from RF of 1,000 megs down to the first IF of 100 megs, and you have some gain and filtering there. Then you go into another second mixer and beat the 100 megs down to 10 megs, and you got some gain and filtering there. And then you go to a third mixer, and you beat the 10 megs down to 455 KC. And so that would be a triple conversion receiver. The very popular ICOM ICR7000, for instance, is a triple conversion receiver. And with good design, that receiver has no spurious responses per se. You tune it to 871 megacycles, and it receives that and nothing but. And you can select which filter you want, which bandwidth, and what method of detection. So thermal conversion receivers, although they're a little bit more elaborate, back in the days when you built it with tubes, they were kind of voluminous, but nowadays you can pack that all into a couple of very small integrated circuits. So if you want a real Cadillac receiver these days for a microwave frequency, there's a good probability you're going to want to buy a triple conversion receiver if you've got the money to do it. These are some of my opinions on this one, Mel. You've worked with double and triple conversion receivers, and I bet you've seen some of their advantages. K2RIW. You got it, Mel.
The quadruple conversion.
Quadruple conversion is also possible, but until you get up to a frequency like 10 gigahertz, you probably don't need it. A good 10 gigahertz receiver would really be done with a 10 gig to 1 gig transverter, and then the 1 gig tunable IF might be a triple conversion. So you put a 10 gig transverter in front of a triple conversion receiver, even though it doesn't say it, your total shack is really a quadruple conversion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, we got completely off the question, of course, for a change. He asked about a HQ180. All right, let me just backtrack, boil this all down so we'll understand what this is all about. During the latter part of late 30s into the 40s, as Dick says, Armstrong did make some phenomenal improvements in what was available up to that time. During the late 1930s, what was very popular after they got away from the early versions of the 20s receivers, Dick said, with all tuning knobs and all that, they had what they called the single conversion superhead, and it only had one IF stage, for example, and it would be basically a straightforward amplified filters, and everything would take place in actually this one IF stage. However, during World War II, the receiver technology started to improve, we started to see multiple conversions. So what came out, the drop? What came out during World War II was very popular military type device, was the what's called the dual conversion superhead, and many of them were using such as a 9 megahertz IF, first IF, and then a second IF, which became very popular. In fact, it's still stuck around, especially right to today's day, of course, is the 455 kilohertz, 455 KHZ, we used to call it kilocycle. And what happened after that, towards the end of World War II, they started coming up with what we call the triple conversion. Now, the triple conversion just took what we were talking about, this dual conversion, and they added, in other words, they went from a higher IF, let's say, about 60 megahertz first IF, 9 megahertz second IF, and 455 kilohertz as the third IF. And that was basically the HQ180 type of receiver that you're talking about. Let me let it drop. Now, there was one design. Now, I don't know if the 180 had this design. For some reason, something just popped into the back of my head. Hommelin, I know, was doing work on a receiver. Now, did this come out in the 180 version? It was known as up-converting. And I don't remember whether or not this, I'm not sure of. If it had one stage instead of triple conversion. I believe it was straight triple conversion. I don't think it employed an up conversion. I think that was in their later receiver, Dick. Over.
Yeah. Vast majority of the super heterodyne receivers we've ever come across usually are down converters. In other words, each stage of mixing and converting goes to a lower frequency. However, the very first band of most spectrum analyzers, the ones that cover microwave frequencies, the very first band on most spectrum analyzers usually is an up conversion for a very good reason, opposite of common sense. Your very first band on a good spectrum analyzer tunes from a very small fraction of 1 megacycle up to either 1 or 2 gigahertz all in one band. You can sweep across the screen, go from essentially 0 to 2 gigahertz. And the way that machine does it, if you really scan 0 to 2 megacycles, the 0 to 2 gigahertz, the total number of octaves you're covering is huge. If you tried to use that with one simple down conversion, you'd have all kinds of image responses. In other words, you put one signal into the spectrum analyzer, and at least two signals would appear on the screen. One is phony and one is real. The very popular in the 1970 time frame spectrum analyzer made by Hewlett-Packard was the 8555 microwave spectrum analyzer. Let me drop. And its very first band did scan from 0 to 2 gigahertz. But you had at least 2 responses on screen for every real signal you put in. And then they had a front panel knob called the identifier. And you press that button, and the real signal would move over 1 box to the right, and the phony signal would move 1 box to the left or 2 boxes to the right. It would move in some other way. And it would tell you the way the other signal moved would tell you, is it a second harmonic mix, is it an image mix, and so on. So you needed a signal identifier if you tried to cover that many octaves with a simple down converter. By up converting, by mixing your 0 to 2 gig band up to, let me pick a number, 2.5 gigahertz as the first IF, and then normal superheterodyne techniques after that, double or triple conversion to bring it back down for detection, you now have a receiver that, with proper design, has no image response. So, yeah, the image is there, but it's 4 gigahertz away, or 4.5 gigahertz away. Very easy to filter it out with a low-pass filter at the front panel. So up conversion, as opposite as it sounds, in the case of a spectrum analyzer, is a very desirable thing to do on the first band only. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, staying with the 180 again for a minute. The thinking of the 180, let me go back again. Let me digress back to those days. Thinking about those days, I never, of course, could afford a 180 when they came out that time. I remember it ogling over things like the Harmon 180 and a few other nice receivers that came out. The thinking of that time was the more conversion stages, the better. And that was proven wrong in a number of instances. So one of the best receivers of that tube era was just a straight 180. They did HQ180, which is a straightforward triple conversion. And the ones that they started fiddling with more conversions, never really took off. They did not find a great advantage of going past the triple conversion. Now, what happened to the single conversion receiver that I alluded to earlier? I was privileged to use a rig called the Elecraft K2, and I was flabbergasted at how this little radio that you put together as a kid, let me let it drop. You put this thing together as a kit. Now, it is not impossible to put together, but anybody's had a little experience in amateur radio soldering and things like that. Maybe a little hard for a newcomer to amateur radio. I don't know. You know, it depends on your skill in electronics, of course, and soldering and testing and things. But it's pretty straightforward in assembling and the printed board and everything. It's very easy to handle. In using the K2, I was flabbergasted, as I said, how this receiver, I would say it's one of the better receivers right now on the market. And I'm not going to say this lightly, that I was so impressed by Elecraft with the K2 that I was really saying to myself, it shows you that there's still a way to put together a decent piece of equipment. Now, and believe it or not, it is of a single conversion type, Dick, over.
The most fun that Mel and I have ever had in our early days with all of our clothes on was to put together a heat kit. And in the early days, that company in Benton Harbor, Michigan, had all kinds of vacuum tube voltmeters and signal generators and the 2-meter rigs and 40-meter rigs and so on. The Tour, the Sixer, the HQ, I can't even remember the model numbers on some of them. They all had Indian names, many of them. So Heathkit made some beautiful kits, and they were fun to build. But the modern-day equivalent is this Elecraft, the K2, and recently I think they came out with the K3. Although it's a kit form, and I think you can also buy it in fully built form, it's an extremely high-performance piece of electronics, very well designed, where it's intended for the serious operator who wants very good image rejection, very sharp filtering, very high fidelity output, high efficiency, and so on. So each one of those stages are very well designed to give extremely high dynamic range, sensitivity, good specific output on the signals transmitter. They worked very hard at the design of that K2 and the K3. A little bit pricey, but a very well-made kit, and the serious VHF, UHF operators are sucking them up, and I think there's a version where you can buy an accessory that makes it a digital signal processor, or what they call now, software-driven radio, where your computer can be talking to it and tell it where you want to go and how you want to detect the signal. So a very good modern piece of equipment. And I bet you you're very tempted after you fiddle with that one. I bet you said, gee, I'd love to own one of those. I bet you said those words, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, I went one stage further. In fact, I took apart. I happen to have moderately priced, came out also a few years back. Never was really excited about the receiver on it, the receiver platform. Transmitter worked excellent. Listen, the transmitters all work today, terrific. But, you know, single sideband is more or less the science. They basically all do it the same way, basically the same ICs, the same RF transistors in the 100-watt series radios, everything. More or less go down the line that way, except for some extra doodads here and there. But because of that receiver design, I decided, I'm going to duplicate the receiver design, and I did that. I put together a homebrew version of the receiver design to fit into the commercial piece of equipment that I owned. And, what a difference. Jeez. I sat there with my mouth fell open. That K2 circuit for the receiver design, especially, is just flabbergasting. And, of course, what they did with the K3, they got everything for the K3. It is a deluxe piece of equipment. And I'll tell you something. If you just built the K2, you're picking a radio that would cost you double or more the price to get something of that quality. Maybe even triple, Dick, over.
Yeah, right now that is the piece of resistance. Software-defined radios and K2. That combination is where the state-of-the-art or the edge-of-the-art seems to be among the serious VHF, UHF people. For instance, there is the microwave update is going to be held in Endicott, Connecticut. I think it's the name of Enfield. Enfield, Connecticut, roughly September or October of this year. The really serious people will be going to Enfield, Connecticut, microwave update, and it goes on from Friday to Sunday. These guys are just living and breathing their favorite VHF, UHF, SHF frequency bands. Real good group of people. And guarantee that software-defined radios and Elecraft will be one of the major subjects in many of the talks that are going to be given. How people have used it, slightly modified it, made measurements as to how good it was, and so on. So that is the receiver for this time frame. And I don't know if K2 has come out with a transmitter. You're going to tell me that, and whether or not you want to go to at least one more of your mailbag, ML. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, the K2 is a complete transceiver. Excellent transceiver all around. Transmitter, receiver, everything. The K3 is got a spectrum display that you can add on. They also came out with a linear amplifier now to fit into the whole package, you know, to fit to the design. the K2 to be QRP. There's a QRP version. You could then put on the amplifier section if you want to start out building it first as a QRP 10-watt radio. You could do that. Then you could add the other section on to make it 100 watts, or if you want to do, take it off. Or, oh, you got all kinds of things. It's very flexible, Dick. It's a beautiful way to really enjoy ham radio and learn something in between, as they say, in between the lines. You're going to see things, and that you'll say, oh, this is what radio does, you know. It's a really, I can say, you mentioned Heathkit. It really is the closest to come to what Heathkit used to provide, Dick, over.
Yeah, at one time I owned a large number of Heathkits, the hi-fi, the vacuum tube voltmeters, signal generators, transmitters, receivers. Heathkit was a good way to get medium good quality at a very nice price. One of the problems they had, though, is they were building a color television receiver kit. And because Southeast Asia started building our color televisions, pretty soon the Heathkit ended up more expensive than a fully built color television set you could buy from the showroom. So for a while that didn't sell very well. People still bought it anyhow because they liked the pleasure of building their own television set, and because they built it, they knew they could easily troubleshoot it and align it and whatever. But Heathkit eventually went out of business, got put out of business, from my point of view, by Southeast Asia. If you take a modern-day so-called rice box, and the dollars you spend versus the amount of equipment you're getting is so favorable that to build it yourself or to even build it as a kit, it's very hard to justify nowadays compared to what you can buy from at least the three major brands, Kenwood, Icom, Yaesu, among others. Astron, I think it is, but you know what I mean. There's a whole lot of things made in Japan that are giving you a lot of quality in a very small package for a rather reasonable price. So except for very special applications like this Elecraft thing, not very many people are building kits today. Want to go to another one? One of your mailbag, Mel? K2KEY?
This WHCDL has some information.
Yeah, and also Joe wanted to give us a comment. It sounds like yours is a little bit more urgent. Sounds like you've got a point of order, Andy, so I'm going to go to you first. W2CDL, K2RIW, the TechNet.
No, it's just this pouring rain over here, about to leave the car. The note to and transmitter for information was designed by Rick Campbell, KK7B, is his call. Just for your information, if you want to look that up.
That's the name I was looking for, KK7B, Rick Campbell. So all of these no-tune transverters, no-tune converters, have all kinds of strip line and microstrip, strip line, into digital filters inside. So when John, KC2UHA, does a web search on KK7B, Rich Campbell, you're now going to find a whole lot of very nicely designed filters, local oscillator assemblies, and whatever, that are extremely easy to build. When he calls them no-tune, he means it. You just build it with the right dimensions, turn it on, and it runs right out of the box, so to speak. Now, Joe had a comment on triple conversion receivers. W2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I didn't. You jumped the gun again. I wanted to answer a question I forgot to sign in earlier, but I don't know if I can get on the list of what you're going to do. So it wasn't about triple conversion receivers.
Okay. Let me go to Mel's second mailbag, and then we'll come back to you, Joe. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW.
A final comment on Heathkit. Heathkit only went out of business because of one reason, really, because the gentleman that owned it got killed suddenly. And then the company that absorbed them up, I worked for. And I knew when they took them over that they had no interest, really, in Heathkit per se, but on some patents. But they don't realize a lot of people, that Heathkit was also, to some extent, in the computer business, the monitor business. So that's basically what was their interest, to try to break into that field of the computer field. That was what caused really the demise of Heathkit. It was intentionally done, basically, Dick. And for a while there, I had in the garage, I had every schematic Heathkit ever had. I had two file cabinets, huge file cabinets with every schematic, and I think I had just about every part that Heathkit ever used in every one of the pieces of equipment piled up there in the garage, because I happened to have obtained it all from a friend of mine that was the Heathkit Service Center of Brooklyn, who went out of business. All right, anyhow, that's enough of that. So, just looking, get part B of this HQ-180 story, over.
Go ahead with the part B.
Okay, now I got the HQ-180. It's got one other problem. Tell me how to go about this. And this one I've heard a number of times. The guy who owns it was an insensitive person, because he just kept smoking and blowing it into the receiver. That's the only way I can describe it. This thing stinks of cigarette smoke. The only way to put it. How do I get rid of this residue called cigarette smoke, because I can't even bring the thing into the house without my parents killing me over?
And you probably remember a few weeks back, Rich N2EO, who refurbishes, updates, and brings into brand new shiny condition Collins radio equipment, because he's a strong enthusiast of Collins. He literally, with some care, with some preparation, takes the covers off the rig and puts it into his dishwasher. And you got to go through an elaborate drying out procedure afterwards, and whether or not you allow the heater function of the dishwasher to operate at full blast for the full length of time, we got to go a little bit slow on that one. You might melt some wax parts that are part of the IF can tuning or whatever, but the dishwasher approach is one severe approach that on at least Collins equipment seems to work like a charm, but people who know how to do it and carefully do it. Other than that, washing out the tar from cigarette smoke on a piece of electronics where it's getting into every little nook and cranny and between the air variable capacitor plates and whatever, that's a tough one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, you hit, as they say, the nail right on the head when you said whack.
IFB2HZER20,
that 180 series, all of them had waxed these IFs that were wound with that wire.
What do you call that wire?
Oh, lift wire. They were wound on cardboard, impregnated with, who knows, I don't know, some kind of slack to harden the cardboard. I don't know how they made that stuff. But then they waxed it over, and that I wouldn't submerge the HQ-120 in a bath of anything, Dick. I think you'd destroy the receiver. There must be other ways that you can, I don't know, clean the thing up. This is a tough one when you're dealing with certain equipment. This is not Collins, Dick, over.
I'm in, Dick.
Go right ahead, John. And then we're going to pick up AB2... HZR, I think it is. You got a comment on this one. John, first, go ahead.
Yeah, I've done a lot of this type of stuff, and the dishwasher works great, but when you're working with the older equipment, you're right, the wax, all you have to do, of course, you remove meters and anything that's sensitive like that. Spray it with Fantastic, believe it or not. Let it sit for about 2 or 3 minutes. Rinse it right under the faucet with just lukewarm water, and if you do that a couple of times, you would be surprised. Not only the smell's gone, the stuff looks like new. And then you can put it in the oven, in your regular oven, at about maybe 100 degrees, and just let it sit in there for 4 or 5 hours, and take it out and let it naturally dry. It works like a charm.
Glad to hear that, John. Sounds like you've done this kind of work, and you got to be careful about not going too high in the temperature to melt the wax that is sometimes used to hold the slugs in position for the IF cans. And sometimes there's a wax paper tube going down the center of the IF can, inside that metal can with the lift wire, pie windings for the actual filter tuning inside the can. And you got to be careful you don't damage those with excess temperature. We did have a sign-in from, it sounded like AB2HZR. Correct me on those call letters, sir. Give me your name and your comments on the subject that's on the table right now. AB2HZR, question mark, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
All right, K2RIW, this is KB2 Hotel Zulu Echo. I don't have a comment on this subject. If there is time, I do have a question I wanted to ask you, having to do with D-Star and EchoLink together, and just a breakdown of something I wanted to see about. If you have time, I didn't mean to break in. I am coming through the EchoLink site, and I got a couple of stations that are in the background listening with me. But if there is time, I would love to bring up a D-Star question for you, and I'll be in here listening. Thank you.
Very fine, Tom. We're going to try to squeeze you in. No promise. And Tom is in the Bronx, but he doesn't have the normal accent. He must be an import. Very fine, Tom. Let's see now. Back to you. Let's see, who's it supposed to go back to? I think it's supposed to go back to Mel. I'm a little bit mixed up here. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, remembering the H2180, I would say no, I would not in any way submerge it in any kind of water. No, not receivers of that type. I think you'd be risking too much. However, what you can do, it comes out of its cabinet so easy. The whole chassis and the whole bit slips out of the cabinet so easy. The knobs come off very easy. The front panel will come off very easy. You'll see it just held very simply to the chassis with the nuts that hold the controls. You can easily pull the panel off. You want to submerge the panel then? Wash the panel down thoroughly. Inside, outside, great. You want to wash the whole cabinet down? No problem. Wash it down, hose it down, do whatever you want. Come to the chassis itself, I would take possibly, or maybe, maybe I don't know, but I would say in a piece of equipment like this, I would take something. I know they sell. They sell that. Call that TF cleaning solvent. I think they call it. I'm not sure. Let me think a minute. How about spray with Fantastic 409? You know, any of those similar things, and just leave it there and just wipe it down. Maybe get most of the stuff up. I think that would do enough to it. Over.
I think you're right, but it's going to take some general loving care. Definitely remove the meters. I wouldn't want any fluids getting inside of a meter movement. Whether or not you allow the air variable capacitors, I think they're going to survive. And getting the gunk out from in between the plates of the air variable capacitor, I think the sprays and dishwashing and whatever, I think that'll do it. I'm a little worried about the IF cans and high temperatures, so I'm trying to think what else. Capacitors, inductors, resistors, usually all of these things can tolerate the solvents and washing fluids that we're talking about and water. Make sure that everything is well dried out before you apply power the next time. And so the tubes themselves, they're easy to clean, the individual vacuum tubes. The HQ180 receiver was a receiver, I'll bet you it had about 20 vacuum tubes. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
About 17 to 22 tubes would not surprise me. No, definitely not. No submersion. Just like Dick says, take tubes out one at a time, just wash them off, get anything with soap, water, any tube, off and all, dry them up, put them back in there into the sockets, no problem. When it comes to the chassis itself, I would take something like Fantastic with a toothbrush to get into little nooks and crannies, you know, and then take and the paneling and the knobs and all that will go a long way. The smoke, do not submerge it. Please, I'm warning you. There's a good chance, I don't care what you're going to do, there's a good chance you will destroy the IF and that old receiver. They may be delicate as it is dried out, and all you'll do is destroy them for sure. So washing is not the answer on the submersion, Dick. I'm going to repeat this. Mic is over.
Very fine, Mel. Sounds like good suggestions. We heard every word you said that time, but on three or four occasions during your last transmission, that push-the-talk button, I know it makes your fingers sore, but that push-the-talk button was becoming a little bit intermittent for a fraction of a second, about three or four times in a row. I think you'd like to know about that. Do you think we should go to one more of your mailbag? And by the way, Mel had one hell of a success 2 weeks ago. As you know, there was a guy who bought a very expensive, high-quality piece of equipment, 80 through 10 meter rig, where every time he connected to a dummy load, it worked like a charm, and every time he connected it to a real antenna, it refused to transmit, no matter what you did. He sent it back to the factory, and the factory declared it a non-confirmed complaint. And so the poor guy, after spending quite a bit of money, was very disappointed, and he sounded like he was on the threshold of giving up ham radio. And we told him to hang in there, that this is definitely fixable, even though it's a very difficult and rare problem. He brought it back to the dealer. The dealer put it onto a demi load. They thought they had a non-confirmed complaint. Because of his confidence that he had by way of the technet, saying this can't possibly happen, it's got to be tested into a real antenna, the dealer connected it to a real antenna and finally confirmed the complaint. And the dealer gave him a brand new in-the-box expensive rig. So we've had one hell of a success by all the suggestions you guys made on this very difficult problem. So I want to go to another one of the mailbag requests. It's up to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm just looking, trying to find something that makes, you know, easy sense. I'm a fairly new ham, and I'd like some help regarding my transceiver. I have an old Gates' FT-102, and I also have a MFJ tuner and a multiband antenna. The instructions say for plate tuning the transmitter indicate that the load, drive, and plate controls should be tuned for a certain reading of about 300 mils. And at this point, the instructions state that I should dip the meter with the plate control. This will tune the transmitter for approximately 100 mils. Let's see now. I did this, and what happened now? Oh, my God. Wait, let me let it drop. Okay. I did this with the instructions and even used a dummy load. However, the tuner instructions say that I can only use a maximum of 30 watts output when initially adjusting the tuner when it's connected to an antenna. Am I supposed to somehow detune this transmitter? Yeah, you can't reduce power on these things. That's another story. Am I supposed some way to detune the transmitter so that I can tune up with this tuner? Oh my God! Yeah.
Yeah, that push the talk button is just starting to give you a little bit of trouble, Mel. And we also can hear you trying very hard to hold on to that microphone correctly. It's making a little bit of a clicking noise. I hope that the FT-102 Yaesu rig, I think it's Yaesu, has a so-called drive control. In other words, one of the knobs on the front panel is called drive. And so in the single sideband tuning mode, I believe you can turn down that drive control, which forces the rig to produce 30 watts of output instead of 100 watts of output. And I think they're recommending you do that until you've got the tuning and loading set correctly. If the tuning is not set for the dip, which means you've resonated the plate circuit, if the plate circuit is out of resonance, and if you were using full drive while doing this tuning procedure, and if you held the key down too long or left it in the transmit mode too long, you could overheat the final tube. You've got at least two choices here. If there's a drive control, use it. If there isn't a drive control, it's not a showstopper. You can transmit intermittently. In other words, you transmit 2 seconds on, 2 seconds off. 2 seconds on, 2 seconds off. And during the time it's on, you're doing the tuning. Because you're only transmitting 50% of the time, the total amount of heating of that tube has just been cut down by 2 to 1. So even if it is mistuned, at full power output, I think that procedure will stop you from damaging that final tube, even if for a long period of time it's not properly tuned. These are some of my suggestions. I bet you've done things like that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
And you get a cigar. That's right. Well, let me see if I can hold this thing the right way, because what I'm doing is I'm trying to prop myself in a spot here, because we have people here. Tables and stuff. All right. There's a few complications here tonight. That's what's happening, basically. You hit the nail, as they say, on the head. Daisu used what was the popular tubes at the time, 6146s. If you reduce the drive on them and you key it down for, say, more than 10 seconds, you begin to damage the 6146. That was the problem. You got to do it. Tune up the rig the way they tell you. Instructions. If you have to reduce the drive down, yes, but you've got to tune that tuner and everything very fast. Because after about 10 seconds, the 6146s are beginning to self-destruct. This was a problem that was very prevalent with 6146 rigs, Dick. Over.
So by doing this intermittent transmit and pause, transmit and pause, 2 seconds on, 2 seconds off, and maybe you can stretch it to 3 seconds on, 3 seconds off. By doing it that way, almost no rig is capable of damaging those 6146 tubes. And a good pair of those, a matched set of those, I'm not sure they've got to be matched, but lots of people think they do. For these rigs that got a pair of 6146s in the final, and you got a match pair of them in there, they're a little bit on the expensive side. You'd rather not damage them by
2 meters.
Now, looks like Bob's going to make a comment on this one, too. K4NV. You're familiar with the FT-102, Bob, and have you used similar tune-in procedures? K4, November, Bravo, Charlie, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2HWW with a comment.
I beat you, Howie. I beat you to it. Good evening, everybody on the TechNet from K4NBC in the borough of Florida. Good evening, Dick. The only comment I really wanted to make was I have a lot of experience with the 6146B tubes, but mostly confined to the General Electric Progress Line radio. And I've tuned many of those transmitters, replaced many of those tubes, and never damaged one. And I spent a lot of time in operate position, and of course I did all my tuning in the tuning position. No experience on the Yaesu, but plenty of experience with the 6146B in the commercial radio. Over to you, Dick, and then you can pass it to Howie at your will there. K2RIW from K4NBC.
Okay, in that retirement state of Florida. As Seinfeld used to say, when you hit 65 years of age, you must retire to Florida. That's the rule. That's the law. Okay, Howie, what have you done to make sure that you don't damage your 6146s? Howie's got it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, if I remember, okay, I don't know about 6140. I use 6146s, but like on the FT-101 and on the Drake line, you would go into the CW position and you play with the mic gain, because the mic gain would basically inject a tone, a 1KC tone, into your CW, into the balanced modulator, and that's how you would do that. So you just reduce... The mic gain would control how much output. You tune the transmitter up, make sure your transmitter is up. When I would turn up a Drake line, I would try to resonate it in low power, then bring it up to full power, and then do then I resonate it. And the Drake line ran sweep tubes, and 6146s are a little bit more rugged. So if, on the FT-102, you should be able to go into the CW position and just turn the mic gain down, because the mic gain controls how much signal you're putting in, how much audio you're putting into the balanced modulator, and they're running the balanced modulator with a 1KC tone that gives you the CW carrier. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, good information, Howie. So if the particular rig you're using because of a slightly skimpy design, does not have a drive control. And I think most of those rigs of that ilk do have a drive control on the front panel. But even if it doesn't have a drive control, how he's telling us that you can fool it into thinking you've got a drive control by going to the Morse code mode and using the mic gain knob as a drive level control. Therefore, you can go to a lower drive level where you can press the transmitter into the transmit mode for longer periods of time without overcooking the 6146. But still, my favorite way of doing it is do it at full blast, but do it intermittently, 2 seconds on, 2 seconds off. And if you want to be conservative, 2 seconds on, 3 seconds off.
Dick?
So as long as there's enough time to cool the tube, you can stop from cooking it. You want to make another brief comment, Howie? Go ahead.
On a lot of those rigs, you could go into the AM position. You can unbalance the balance modulator, go into AM, and you're running reduced output. That's how you would do it. Now, most of those rigs had a drive control, but that's not a real drive control. That was grid tuning. That drive control was basically the input state to the grid of the final amplifier. That's what that was. That was the grid tuning. And if you detune that grid tuning, you are now, you might have spurious. You don't really want to use the drive control, because on a lot of those radios, it's not like an Eichel 720 where you had a grid tune and a drive control where you were set for so many MA, because that's not a Class C output state. Those things are running Class A, B1. So the best way to do this is to go into the mic gain control. Anybody who ran a Drake 4 line would know that. Or an FT101, is you can go into the AM position and turn down the mic gain so you would run maybe 25 or 30 watts so you wouldn't kill it. Just remember, that's how you did those in those days. You could run, it was a double sideband AM. It was basically an AM with just one carrier, one side removed. Dick, go ahead.
So as we're all starting to find out, the owner's manual really doesn't tell you all the capability of the rig. Guys who are good fiddlers, like Bob and Howie and Mel, have found other ways, intermittent transmitting, and other ways of decreasing the drive during the tuning process to protect the tubes. So a thoroughly naive guy with a brand new rig might make the mistake of going into the transmit mode for 60 solid seconds while he takes his own sweet time reading the manual and slowly turning those knobs and finding the resonant point. And if your transmitter is running full power output or attempting to, and the final stage is not properly tuned, then all of the power you're putting into that final tube is not going out the antenna port. It's being turned into heat. The heat can make the plate circuit glow red hot, and that starts decreasing the age of the tube and doing some damage. You've got to be a little bit careful about that. K2KEY to pick it up. K2RIW.
Take one more comment, Dick.
Please stand by, Howie. Mel, go ahead.
Exactly. The drive control on the FT101 of 2 series was not part of the audio gain control. The tube, it was a variable capacitor. That system in there was a hybrid, basically, rig. They were starting to branch the transistors, so they put transistors in the receiver, earlier stages and all, but the output was basically designed like the old rig. It had a 12HL7, if I remember correctly, or a 6GK, no, cobalt, right? Because the thing was also mobile, where you could put it in a mobile. They had a power supply for it, so the FT-102 could be in a mobile. The mobile supply with the jumper was that plug in the back with umpteen pins, and what you did, it wasn't a Jones plug, it was, I think it was octal, 11-pin octal or some goddamn thing. So when you put it in the mobile, in other words, the tubes, the 6146 is wound up in series to filament, and the driver tube was a 12HL7. So that has, with a sensor tap on the filament. So when you used it on the home power supply, the filament jumped to 6 volts because you let it drop. Because then you have 6 volts, now the 6146 filaments round up in parallel. The 12HL7 was, I could say, the sensor tap
was now wired to the center tap of the filament, so it ran off 6 volts. And by tying 2 pins of the filament together and using the 3rd pin of the filament for the 6-volt system. So your drive control was a variable capacitor. So they used to say the torque on the air of the time with all those rigs was called short burst tuning. In other words, you put the key down. You had it to tune it. You had to push your key down. Close the key. So you use it, your CW key, short burst, 10 seconds, you tune it. Otherwise, go 6140. Guarantee any of the tubes that were damaged. If they just send them back, Dick, over.
Okay. Do you think you've got any other emails that we should handle tonight, Mel, or do you think we should go on? K2KEY? K2RIW?
Okay, go on. That's all. I have to look through here, you know, stuff, but I think we hit some nice topics, so let Howie make his final comment, and I think we should go on, Dick, over.
Okay, Howie, you got it. And Howie, be a little bit brief. You make your point, but sometimes you repeat it 2 or 3 times, and maybe they don't need that. Over to you, Howie.
Say, you're learning by the school of hard knocks. The only question I want to ask now, on the FG-102, do the mic gain control the output like it does on the Drake line? Dick, you know the Drake line. The mic gain controls the output, and that's all I had to say, WD2HWW.
Yeah, the main point we want to make here is that the owner's manual usually does a pretty good job of telling you the correct tune-up procedure, but it may not be the only tune-up procedure. Very few of the owner manuals that I've ever seen have recommended the burst transmission mode. 2 seconds on, 2 seconds off. And that is absolutely not damaging to a rig. It'll protect the living daylights out of it. So no matter whose manual you're reading, no matter what brand of rig it is, no matter how bad final stage is, if you're only transmitting 50% of the time, or 30% of the time, you can get away with murder without doing any damage to the rig. Alrighty, at this time we should be going over to Paul, WS2N. I know that we got both Joe and Tom, who want to ask a further question. Just to make sure, I know that you've got to go to work tomorrow, Paul, and if we're getting to your bedtime hour, let us know, and we'll go right now. And if you think we can wait, it's up to you. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Now you can go on, Dick. Now I'm retired. No more playing around out in the field. Back to you, Dick.
And when it comes to the space report, I got a very nice letter from Don in Bayside, AB2IF, where there's an extremely nice article about the Webb, the James Webb Space Telescope in the August 1st issue of Wall Street Journal. We'll be discussing that. And it looks like it's being threatened with a Congress cancellation. That worries me. Okay, Joe, I know you had a question. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, you got it, Joe.
Thank you, Dick. K-2-R-I-W and TechNet, W-H-U-R-Y-Y. I have an HB-8640B signal generator, just like you own. One day, very recently, I was using it, and I switched ranges on a counter unit to make it to read a little more accurately. It would not come out of that mode. It actually froze where the counter was displaying like more, you know, like basically zeros. I went to back the unit and it wouldn't come out of that mode, and I basically turned the power off on the unit, let it sit for about 30 seconds, turned the power back on. Now the counter doesn't come on and the generator doesn't function either. On FM or AM, I can get the thing to generate a tone. That seems to work. And all the power supplies inside have the correct voltages as per the service manual. Any ideas?
Yeah, the failure that I had with my 8640B Hewlett Packard, let me think now. Is it digitized? No, it is not. It is an analog signal generator with digital feedback. The frequency counter can be used in the feedback lock mode, and so it acts as if it is a synthesized signal generator, has the stability of a synthesized signal generator, but has the frequency purity of an analog signal generator. It's a beautiful piece of equipment. And the particular failure mode I ran into, when you opened up the case, I may be confusing now the 8640 with the spectrum analyzer of Hewlett Packard, but in either case, there's a whole bunch of light emitting